Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 220 featuring Greg Lynn, who is a very well-renowned architect who I knew when I was in architecture school. He was a guest lecturer over at Rice University, and I was enamored by his work because he was one of the first people that really started pushing the boundaries of what you could do on computers with design. It wasn't just CAD stuff that he was doing. He was looking at things like wavefront and alias and fluid simulations and strange things like that that you could use to do interesting designs. Nowadays, it's actually become quite common, and it's pretty amazing to see some of his work. So really interesting guy. He teaches at UCLA. He's got his own firm called Form. And he just has been spending apparently most of his time starting a robotics company that is about to release their first robot that they're going to go for sale this summer. The name of the company is called Piaggio Fast Forward, and the name of the robot is called Jita.
Is this the bull robot?
Yes.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, Melissa. It's this robot that follows you around and can carry a case of wine in case you need it.
Chris was explaining the whole concept to me and described it in ways I'd understand by telling me how much wine it could carry.
That's how Greg described it, too.
Oh, there you go. I don't feel so weird now.
Don't feel so weird. It was perfect. So it's a really interesting podcast, and Greg is an absolutely amazing person, and he's one of the top design guys in the United States right now to be talking to. So really cool to be able to talk to him. And I want to thank Ben West for, making the introduction back to Greg and being able to get him on here. Okay, Melissa, we have some announcements. You are getting ready for FMX.
Yes. Our event page has launched on our site.
Yep.
So now all of our talks are listed, which is great news.
Yes.
So FMX this year runs from the 30th of April to the 3rd of May in Stuttgart.
Right, again. So in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, not long. And on the 1st of May, we have our V-Ray day, or rather V-Ray afternoon.
Yes.
Which runs from 2 o'clock through to 6.
Okay.
And we've got four great speakers that we've just announced, and we've posted on social as well so people can find more information there. But we've got Lux Film.
Yeah.
So they've worked on the Grand Budapest Hotel and Independence Day, done some fantastic work. And they're doing presentation on their animated feature called Manu the Swift.
Yep.
So that'd be really nice.
Which is a full animated feature they did, and they rendered it all in V-Ray. It's really cool.
Yeah, it looks really cute.
Yep.
Then we've got Unexpected, and they're doing some really cool demos concerning mixed reality and the HoloLens.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be good. And Goodbye Kansas are on board. They're going to be showing their Walking Dead cinematics. So there's lots of characters and environment work there.
Pretty gory, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's all the good stuff. And Ambassadors, which are a group I hadn't actually heard of before, and I'm so glad I learned more about them.
Okay.
Because they've got some fantastic work. They do a lot of blending of special effects, kind of set miniatures and 3D digital work too.
Right.
And they've got some great animations to show off there.
Awesome, awesome. And then the next big event, of course, we've mentioned it many times, is Total Chaos, which is happening May 16th through the 18th. 16th is master classes. 17th and 18th is the talks. It's going to be pretty interesting. I think we may be very close to selling out all tickets. We may have actually sold out tickets. I don't know.
Yeah, I think
so
we are.
If you want to go, sorry if you're out of luck, but go check very soon to make sure that if there's still a ticket available, there probably won't be much for long. So go check that out. But a very exciting event. Lots of stuff going on at Total Chaos. So exciting to see that. I think that's about all we have right now.
I think that's it. Okay. Since last week.
I know. We're still working on a bunch of new announcements that will be happening next week and a week after that. So lots of new product stuff coming out. But just want to make sure you guys are aware of FMX and of Total Chaos. And unfortunately, I will not be making it to FMX this year. But make sure, and enjoy yourself while you're there. Hang out at the Maritime Hotel because that's where I would normally be.
That piano bar.
Yes.
Is the place to be.
It is. It is. It is. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Enjoy this great podcast with Greg Lynn.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
You've done a few podcasts before, haven't you?
Yeah, a few.
Did you do a podcast? Did you host a podcast or something like that before?
No, for the CCA, Canadian
Center
of Architecture.
Yeah, that's what it was.
For the Digital Archive.
Yep.
We had like, gosh, I think in the last show, 12 people, maybe even 14. And we didn't know how to do a symposium, and they didn't all get along. So we did like a talk show where one would come out, I'd talk to them for 15 minutes, and then they would move to the couch, and then the next one would come out.
That's what it was. I remember now where I saw it, because I was going to do an interview podcast with Patrick Schumacher.
Yeah, sure.
And so I watched that interview of yours with him before that. So that was pretty interesting. Now I remember that.
Yeah, the talk show format was pretty great. Yeah. I mean, it's better than a symposium, I think.
Yeah, I like that idea. Mm-hmm. We should do more talk show formats instead of...
There you go. Good idea.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of our...
We'll just put a camera in here, like I've been encouraging Chris to do. Anyway.
Yeah, it's been pretty cool. So anyway, I'd mentioned that the first time I met him at Greg was at Rice University in 1993, which was a long time ago. And I was one of those guys that sort of like gravitated towards the computers, right? I was they had installed all these SGIs and Wavefront and stuff like that. And so in order to figure out what the heck I was going to do with these things, I was sort of looking at people like Sanford Quinter, and then you came in and you sort of talked about using those tools, using NURBS and things like that to design architecture. And that became really fascinating to me. And that, like, 93 was a long time ago. That was 25 years ago. So, but you've always been interested in the exploring how a tool, I guess, could possibly change your design process. There's a lot of that I talk about. So how did that inspire you back then, and how does that evolve in the last 25 years? It's got to be a lot of things that have changed.
From there to robots.
Sure. Well, I mean, I see it as almost seamless, although it probably doesn't make much sense that way.
It's a continuum.
I was always a geometry geek.
Yeah.
And so started using like Bentley, MicroStation, way back when, because it had splines.
Right.
And knew that SGIs and programs like Alias were very powerful spline modelers. And got a hold of some demo software, including Wavefront.
Yep.
And realized that actually the animation was the thing that was the most exciting. And simulated physics.
Ah, right.
So for me, that was like a surprise. I would say of everything, that was the biggest surprise, is that along with this geometry tool came physics.
Right.
And animation and rigging and all that kind of stuff. And so for years, I just played around with what good is rigging as like a replacement for a compass, or what good is a spline as a replacement for a polygon, or... And I think it was mostly a focus on language, like shapes and volume and space, and how that would change with the tool.
Right.
But I have to say, in the last 10 years, I've really shifted my interest to more thinking about how those tools would change the space itself, not so much in its volume, but in the way things communicate with each other, the way things move.
Right.
The way people interact with each other. I think... The technology is almost the same, but the focus is very different now. Like now if I'm doing rigging, I'm actually thinking about rigging a robot and how far or close it follows a person.
Right.
Not really thinking about deforming a space using a rig.
Right. But I think it was an important part of that process, right? To learn to break the rules of how things are done, right? The architecture was was very much a part of a, you know, I remember that in architecture school learning about order and symmetry, et cetera, et cetera. And your process was like, okay, now that you know that, you can completely break that process, right? And it, the way that you described it was how you follow nature in a way. And the natural form is something that we look for symmetry, we look for things of that nature. Can you explain a little bit about that symmetry process and how natural forms break symmetry or create symmetry?
Well, so I would be careful. I feel like you're setting a trap for me. So Santa Fe Institute and, you know, simulating physics and biology and simulating the growth of an organism was being done on computers, the same computers. So like if SGI was hosting an event, there might be two or three architects that might be there. But there were also like physicists and biologists and, you know, so I saw what some of those people were doing and got very interested in growth and form. Right. And just happened to get a hold of a book by William Bateson, who was Greg Bateson's dad.
Yes.
Who wrote a book on symmetry breaking. He invented that term. And here I was being educated that symmetry was order, and then you would vary off of that order. And Bateson's argument was, no, symmetry is a default in the absence of genetic information. Everything defaults to symmetry. So if you take away genetic information, let's say for a thumb, you, in place of the thumb, just get four fingers mirrored. And his whole argument, which he blew away the concept of symmetry, he didn't replace it, he just flipped it. Where he said symmetry is not order, symmetry is disorder. And order is information, and when you lose information, you get more symmetry. And the more sophisticated an organism is, the more symmetry breaking it'll have. Mm. And he built these little machines to demonstrate this called Bateson machines, which were like insect legs and stuff, but as a little wood machine with gears.
Okay.
And he could turn it and he could show if you take away information for this leg, you're going to get this level of symmetry. And I, one of the first things I did in Wavefront was model that Bateson machine as a mechanism.
Okay.
And
so as something you could animate as a rig, right?
Literally as a solid model with constraints and hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up using that for the Cardiff Bay Opera House competition. It was all just pure like Bateson rule symmetry breaking.
Okay.
But it was this very, again, it was almost like as simple as a mechanical compass, just a more sophisticated machine.
Right.
From the 1890s, but thrown into a computer and used digitally.
Right.
But it did give me a thing that looked very organic. So I've always been interested in the organic, but I've never like tried to mimic nature or anything. I always look for a new model in science and see how architecture could import that and get something different.
Why do you think that architects, you know, and even a little bit today, but why do you think there was a reluctance to explore organic form so much? It was so much set on those sort of rules of, you know.
Well, maybe the reason I squirm when you say that is because I had a mother that took me to every Frank Lloyd Wright house in the Midwest.
Okay.
And all the Louis Sullivan stuff with the whole Sullivan seed germ, organic, and, you know, and learned how to draw all that ornament and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was always looking for something more than the, let's say, the decorative part of organic form, like different than Bruce Goff. Like, I mean, Bruce Goff was a great architect, but in those
Victor
buildings.
Victor Horta or stuff like that, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But I'm a little bit, you know, like I kind of, my skin crawls a little bit in that stuff because it's a little too Geiger-esque in the sense that it's looking like a machine's version of organic.
Uh-huh.
And I'm much more interested in the geometry, let's say, than the than the ornament.
Right.
And the materials too.
Right.
But and, yeah, I mean, we were all, I would say a lot of architects, we were very tightly following what was going on in the sciences when people were simulating things on computers.
Yeah.
And even Charles Jenks, you know, was probably the most important person in pulling all of us together. Like he got Brian Goodwin and Dane Plummer and all these people at events at the AA in London, all simulating growth. And the architects were like, this is, so much more sophisticated than dragging cubes around and bullying.
Right.
Right. Yep. Yeah, but that is something that's very important, right? Is because the tools so often, the tools that are used sort of end up creating a predictable form in some ways.
Well, I mean, trace that to a T-square and a triangle, right? Like suddenly if you can make everything at right angles or 30-degree angles or 60-degree angles, then that's what they become.
Right.
At the same time, you know, we actually had this conversation with Tom Main too about it's hard to create models of that stuff, like physical models. Like just go ahead and create a physical model of a sphere. It's not an insignificant undertaking.
Yep.
And so some of that stuff just presented itself as difficult.
Right.
But it's interesting when you talk about the spline models and some of those, like, you know, we had a chat at one point about there was this whole time of Boolean exercise, like when Formsy came onto the spectrum of things, and like suddenly now that was a way of exploring geometry. And it's fascinating to me to think that, you know, here's like an idea of just alias as being another avenue into like, oh, let's free the expression of that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. But alias is interesting. It was very few people back then that were really thinking about it as an architectural form. It was a very unique thing, yep. Right? People were still thinking about, you know, using AutoCAD, right? And now I think that has become finally, in a lot of ways, become much more embraced, right? Tools like Rhino, which are kind of like an evolution of alias at the time now for architecture. And you can see like a lot of more interesting architecture that's sort of able to appear based on these tools.
Right.
But do you think that, you know, obviously you were thinking about this 25 years ago and now it's become a lot more common. So you have, like you've mentioned, you've had an evolution through that process that you've noticed. What can you sort of narrate sort of that process of evolution of how you've gone from doing that? I'm sure at this point you're thinking well beyond that.
Well, I think one of the important things that came out, again, of those tools, the formal tools were important.
Right.
So Formsy was very much like, what are the building blocks that architects work with and how can we assist them to do more things digitally? And that was really about a modeler. Mm-hmm. And the thing about when Softimage got bought and Autodesk grabbed Wavefront and Alias and threw them into Maya together.
Right.
What then was on everybody's desktop was both a modeling tool, but also an animation tool.
Yep. Yep.
And I remember Bob McNeil coming by my office in Venice a couple times a year and looking at what we were doing with Mel scripts and procedural modeling, let's say, which also is where like Eisenman and Chris Yesio started with Formsy was a procedural modeler.
Yeah, right.
And all that ability to like run a script, change a variable, rerun it, and do procedural modeling, the complexity that was possible was really exciting. And I think that's where architecture all went.
Okay.
And I think that's where Grasshopper,
yeah.
Right. No, that's totally Grasshopper.
Right.
So, but I think more than the formal part, the procedural part is probably what's the biggest impact. I think the thing you see is, yeah, there's this new language.
Okay.
But frankly, the result of it, I believe, is the power of a procedural tool. And once you have a procedural tool, you can then have that tool talk to machines. So if you want to fabricate and machine things, if you want to build a BIM model that has a high degree of fidelity, you can load information in that procedural modeler and rerun it again. It's really changed, I think, both the workflow, but also the level of complexity of what comes out.
Yeah, I think there's the procedural modeling or the process, the creative process that happens from those types of things, I think is fascinating because it is, the design process becomes part of discovery more than imagination has a role, but I think discovery has an important role.
You can react to things in a way that you probably couldn't before, right? So rather than everything being 100% proactive of I've got one idea and I'm going to express that, or maybe I'm going to sketch that in a lot of different ways, having it based in something like this, for instance, Grasshopper, you know, testing different recipes and things like that to be able to react to it to find the, you know, the thing that you're attracted to, I think is a fascinating change.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, you also have to keep in mind that everybody became an amateur
right away.
Yeah. I mean, going through the archaeology of the digital with the CCA, you get to see that really raw amateur moment where everybody who was like a master at pen and ink drawings suddenly becomes a total dilettante with a 3D modeler.
Yep.
And so I think the, you know, the happy accident was the currency of architecture for about 10 years.
Right.
But once you have one happy accident, you don't want to have the same one another time. You want to master it.
Right.
And so I think now you're really seeing people in their scripts and procedures developing as much a language mm-hmm. as they are in the, let's say, in what would have been called modeling.
Right.
So Mark Fornes and people like that, I mm-hmm. think, you know, one of the things that I find exciting is that now we're at a mature enough point where that kind of scripting is no more what it was when I was playing around with it, which is let's model an environment and, you know, put a rigged form into it and see what it does. Right. Now it's much more like, you know, let's design a foiling trimaran and make sure we're optimizing the thing to be ultra high performance.
Yeah.
And so for me, I feel like I've evolved from that happy accident place of, you know, simulated physics and seeing what happens to forms.
Right.
To now being able to design like a Formula One level resolved object that's super high performance.
Right.
Yeah. I saw some of the work that you've done in terms of yachts and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that got it evolved from what you've been doing?
Well, it was, first of all, it's, you know, it was the biggest experiment I've ever stepped into.
Okay.
And for me, it was because it combined two interests of mine. One, computational fluid dynamics.
Yes.
And particle flow, all that stuff, with carbon fiber. And so I wanted to learn about how to build in carbon fiber in the most high performance way possible. And then also wanted to see how computational fluid dynamics could drive something that had both styling concerns as well as high performance concerns.
Right.
So it really was like a nexus of a whole bunch of things I was interested in,
uh-huh.
but totally irrelevant to probably anybody but me.
Yeah, I think it's great to see, because when I saw the designs of those yachts, I was like, well, this just makes sense. You know, based on everything I've seen from you and Allison, like the evidence, like it actually almost seems like you should have been doing this from the beginning, because it's so natural form that I think needs a lot of, it's really interesting to me. But fluid dynamics is another thing. So if you look at fluid dynamics, and that is also based on the world of physics and discovery, right? So there's things that you do in simulation still for those events, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And more and more, I'm really interested in crowd simulation and pedestrian simulation software.
Okay.
I mean, over at UCLA and in the Angavanta, that's the thing I feel like I'm bringing to the students more than anything, even more than robotics.
Okay.
Is having them start to design the same way with, say, like the Port Authority Gateway project, which was the first thing I ever did that had simulated physics and particles in it.
Okay.
You know, now, like 30 years later,
right.
maybe longer than that, like now, actually you can do that and not like hit enter and then go away for 3 days and hope something happens. You
could
actually do it interactively.
Yes.
And it really changes the way you think about space.
Yeah.
You know, when you're blowing people through a space and looking at the flows and patterns, it really changes the way you design.
Right.
And if you do it right at the beginning, rather than like simulating a fire escape or something.
Right.
It's a really powerful tool.
Right. Yeah. So do you feel that simulation still has an important role to play in this world?
Nope.
In the architecture world?
The biggest.
The biggest.
Yeah, yeah. No, the biggest. I mean, with the robotics company, Piaggio Fast Forward, we're doing a lot in simulation. Okay. I mean, if you're doing a, you know, a machine that's going to go out in the world, you have to be thinking of it in simulation because you just, you need that time of seeing what the edge conditions are for how things behave.
Right.
So, yeah, before we started building stuff, we were simulating it in like a robotic simulation tool like Gazebo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I think simulation's the currency of design more and more.
Okay. Awesome. Well, can you explain a little bit about your robotics company and where that started?
Sure. So 3.5 years ago, Jeffrey Schnapp called me and said, and Jeffrey is he's a joint appointment at the GSD at Harvard and also in CompLit, and he is very informed about digital culture and humanities.
Okay.
And happened to be a semi-professional motorcycle racer.
Okay.
So he said, look, I've met all these people at Piaggio Group who have race bikes and scooters, and they're interested in the future of mobility in the United States. Would I come talk to them? And we had a talk, and next thing we knew, we set up a company to try to figure out where light mobility and autonomous technology would be on sidewalks and streets. Okay. So think Vespa scale rather than self-driving car.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And after, you know, with a design team and researchers of, you know, eight of us, we decided that augmenting human mobility and making cities walkable was the thing that most people rate highest when they think about where they're going to live, is how walkable it is and the things they can walk to.
Right.
And so we've built a very intelligent kind of family of robots that understand pedestrian etiquette and understand how to move through a crowd and understand how to go through a door with you and, you know, understand how we move and augment us. So instead of replacing a delivery person, we're trying to help people walk around their neighborhood and go grocery shopping and take their kids to school and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So where, I mean, you're manufacturing robots at this point, or you're?
Yeah. We're standing up a factory in Boston
for
where we're going to assemble them. And we start a nationwide tour where we're going around to different cities and towns and showing people the impact they can have. And we start selling them this summer.
What are some of the impact that they can have?
Well, about, depends where you are, but around 20 to 25% of car trips are less than a mile.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's just because you're going to go get 2 gallons of milk or a case of wine, and you're not going to walk those 6 blocks. You're going to get in a car.
Right.
And more stuff also is coming to people. Right. So, you know, when we started, everybody said, like, is this the thing that's going to, like, get the burrito from the street through the window to my kid on the couch? And we're like, no, this is the thing that's going to get your kid off the couch to go buy burritos for family dinner.
Right.
You know, so we really see the impact as getting people not even so much more active, but more connected, so that they're heads up, walking around their neighborhood, knowing who the people that have shops are, knowing who their neighbors are, just more being kind of off the screen and walking around. But with, frankly, one of the highest pieces of technology a person would interact with in terms of a robot that follows you around on sidewalks.
Right. Do you think that, I mean, Lon and I have been having this discussion about, you know, we're going to get to a time not too distant from now where, you know, your child is what, three or four?
Yeah, she'll be four in June.
She'll be four in June, but by the time she's 18, she probably won't have a need to learn how to drive.
could be.
So the possibility of mobility through a town or through where you go to where you want to go is going to be, could be very much simpler and change the entire dynamic of how you operate within a city. And, you know, parking garages going away, everything going away. Do you feel that that's going to, you know, things like what you're doing in the robotics world, is that going to impact the influence of spaces and cities as well?
For sure. No, for sure. And also just humanity. I mean, when I've done some work with Nike, and it's incredible how Nike is turning us into superheroes. I mean, literally, that's their mission. It's their, you know, getting 350-pound athletes to dunk basketballs and run, you know, 4-second 40-meter dashes.
Right.
So, I mean, it's very likely your daughter will have all kinds of superpowers through technology.
I think she already does.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, for us, there's a vision of the future where where our kids are going to just sit on a screen and things are going to just come to them before they even think them.
Right.
And that's Wally.
That's already happening.
It is.
Yeah.
But there's also that world where, you know, you can walk 10 miles with 100 pounds of stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, and not need to get in a car. So, I mean, we're looking at walking a mile or a mile and a half. Yeah. But when we started giving these robots to people, average distance was like over 3 miles.
So describe these robots exactly.
They're just like a little ball that carries 2 grocery bags. And it does everything with vision. So it doesn't have GPS or mapping. It just locks on to a person and then identifies people, identifies wheelchairs, dogs.
Right.
Like just up the street, I walk around every morning with one. Half the time I just pair it to my dog and let the dog walk, and half the time I pair it to me. But it's, you know, it really is just to carry your stuff, but help you make a decision to walk around instead of either taking a ride share or jumping in a car.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, so where I live, I'm, you know, very close to a couple of different grocery stores and things like that. And, you know, my mother-in-law comes to visit all the time. One of the first things that we had to do was get her a foldable shopping cart so she could go out and be mobile, because she wanted to get outside and everything. Like, this would be perfect for our house, right? Because we could go to all of those places that are within that radius.
Yep.
My mother-in-law is not going to get on a bird scooter or, yeah, you know, God forbid, please don't, you know, which is a different, you know, that's a whole different kind of mobility scenario. But, I wish I would have spotted you with the robot following you. Would have loved to see that.
Yeah. I think it's a really cool idea to have something that's the thing, right? Technology is going to, it's still at a stage where it's helping you as much as possible, right? It's making your life a little bit simpler, making things, you know, making you more mobile, I think is a really great idea, because I think you're right. A lot of people think they're just going to sit at a house and there's a drone that's going to deliver your food to you.
Yep.
And that's a shame.
Well, it's funny. The I attribute it to thinking of the civic first, which every architect really does start, not so much even thinking about their client, but thinking about what does this mean to the city? What does this mean to, you know, citizens?
Yeah.
Right.
It's where you want to start. So when we started a robotics company, it was really about, like, how's this going to change daily life in the street and quality of life and all that stuff?
Right.
And it's crazy, alien, and counterintuitive to most startups you talk to, who are all solving really small pain points. Like, how do we solve the problem of getting it to the front door? Or how do we solve the problem of the last mile? Or how do we solve, it's really small problems in enormous markets that make you a $1 billion company right now.
Huh.
And it's very counterintuitive to say, like, let's change the whole paradigm.
The dynamic, yeah.
Yeah. Just start with the smaller problems.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, and you know, I know, like, a lot of people are saying, it, you know, MIT, it used to be, let's solve big problems. Now it's just like, let's come up, let's solve a small problem and have a exit event and cash out.
Right.
And
go on to another problem.
Yeah. That's really the discourse. And I find that very frustrating. Frankly, with this moment in time, is that everybody's solving pain points. Nobody's solving
at
big
least
problems.
It's not, let's invent a problem.
Yeah.
Let's invent a new problem.
Yeah.
But I think that's right. I think there's a lot of, you know, if you look, especially, you know, in Silicon Valley right now, there's so many companies that are like, this solves this one little niche, right? And then they sell it to Facebook and then they do the next one, right?
Yep.
Why do you think that's happened? What do you think what's the process that's creating that problem?
We're probably at the beginning of something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the lowest hanging fruit is identify the biggest industry and start to solve some of the, you know, difficult but small problems to generate a massive revenue.
Okay.
And, you know, by the way, the biggest one lurking out there is the construction industry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's kind of interesting to see how so many companies are looking at it and thinking this really looks complicated, but there's so much waste and there's so much inefficiency. how can we get in and start to solve all those pain points and reconfigure the whole industry?
Right.
And architects don't seem to be either aware of it or feel like, I think they feel like they are going to be very downstream to that process. And frankly, they're maybe going to be the target of that process or one of the targets.
It's not a, it actually shouldn't be a different process. It's all one thing.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of architects that are trying to drive it. I mean, you know, Frank Gehry's trying to drive it. Mm-hmm. Moshe Safdie's trying to drive it. Tom's trying to drive it. There are a lot of people that are trying to get in front of that and do something about it. But in general, everybody's just...
Well, how do you start by making something more efficient in architecture, right? You have to think about how it's being made or what's the process.
So I had... I just read an article about Moshe Safdie recently. He made it come to the forefront. And I had an opportunity to work with him and his team for years when I was in Boston, and we were doing visualization for, you know, projects all over the world. And I always sort of loved his philosophy, but he had just said something very recently about solving a little problem. Very specifically, he added a, basically an extension to his own house that was, basically a greenhouse with a shaded structure on it that led out onto an open balcony. And he's like, how do we make these spaces for us to be able to enjoy the outdoors four seasons? Obviously, that's a problem in Boston, right? And how do we control the airflow, the sunlight, you know, those things? But it's literally we're talking about, you know, a very small little portion of somebody's house. Now, on a project, you know, that Moshe would deliver would be on a massive, you know, a massive scale, and suddenly that affects, you know, a much wider swath of humanity. But I just think that little idea has such a resonating effect, which I think it fits perfectly into that narrative of, you know, what are these little things that, that we can fine tune for the right reasons, right? For all the right reasons.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, for me, the it's very Wild West right now in terms of what's the scope of how an architect can get engaged. Mm-hmm. And when I see companies like Katara trying to generate a vertical stack of everything from design to even bridge financing, construction management, contracting, fabrication, they're doing it all under one roof or several roofs. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a wake-up call.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised how many architects are just like, you know, oh, like that has nothing to do with me. I'm going to lose some work to them. Like that's how everybody looks at it is like, oh, well, that's one less five-story timber mixed use building I'll get to do.
Right.
But it's going to change the whole paradigm of how people practice.
Yeah. So they're going to have to be responsible for thinking about how to actually build things in some ways, right?
Well, yep. I mean, to me, there's that step beyond is I've been surprised at how few have turned into the developer as well, right? Like, I remember when Autodesk built their building in Waltham, that was one of the first times where they had sort of owner, architect, developer relationship all under one, you know, under one roof, which held everybody accountable to all the different parts of the system. So they had their own expertise, but essentially, everybody owned the project. It wasn't like I'm a service for hire. I'm going to design this thing and then walk away, or you're going to call me in 6 months when we need to fix a few things or whatever. But the ability to find a way to take ownership of that, and then you have a vested interest in every part of the process, right? Because how efficient it runs, its effect downstream, and so on is 100%, you know, part of your sphere. If it's just I'm going to do this one thing and go on to the next project, you have a different relationship.
Yep. No. And I think, I mean, as much as possible, I try to have equity in anything I'm involved with. More and more, I really don't want to get paid a fee or even worse, like get paid by the hour.
Right.
You know, I would much rather have a stake, even if it means much more increased risk.
Right.
So.
Well, you're going to have a different mindset. Right. And you're a different ownership and mentality for that approach.
Yeah. But do you think that getting involved, what are the risks of getting involved at that level though?
Failure.
Yeah. They're huge, you know?
Right.
I mean, so, that's, that's the reason why it's not pervasive. I mean, essentially a development company operates more like a finance, you know, institution. They're more like a bank than they are anything else.
So what's the advantage then?
What I'm saying is the advantage is all the upsides, the same upsides that come with any kind of risk.
It's interesting because, you know, I'm just thinking about it in terms of, you know, because we do a lot of relationships and visual effects companies as well, right? So I always think about the visual effects company that decides we're always a service industry and we always get such slow margins. Why not just make our own movie? And then every time they do that, they fail.
Right.
Right. And so it's the same idea. If an architect becomes their own developer.
It's the same idea in the fact that there's limited runway. You have limited room for a mistake. So they don't have the same access to finances.
It's probably if all the visual effects companies got together and said, none of us are going to work for a fixed fee. We're all going to work for whatever our time and materials are. And then the profit is going to be made on the backside, right, just the way an actor would do, mm-hmm, or right, the way a director would do, or the way a screenwriter would do.
Yep.
Then you're in a different equation. And, you know, some visual effects companies are going to do really well with that because they're going to do great visual effects for the right movies.
Yeah. Right.
And other companies are going to fail.
Right.
But as long as somebody good is willing to do that work for hire, then that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've tried over and over again to say, look, just, you know, give me like a 3% fee, but then take whatever you think the rest of that 3% fee is, give it to me on the backside. Like when you sell the building, I'll hang out, I'll let my kids cash out of it.
Right.
But I know the building I'm going to design is going to sell for more in 30 years than the building somebody else will design.
Right.
So I'm more than happy to take my 3%. And be an investor with you.
Right.
And then I'm motivated to do a better job. I'm motivated to make sure everything's going to be durable and certified. And, you know, then it's a different equation. We're partners now.
Right.
It's all better. But every time you say that, they'll say, hey, I got somebody even better and more famous than you.
Right.
That's going to do this for 4% and not pester me with this ownership.
Right.
So until you can get enough people to agree at a certain level, it doesn't work.
Right.
But it's what happened in the film industry.
Yeah. It's interesting that's, you know, it's the same. So many similarities, because I think that's the thing. That's the curse of a service industry in a lot of ways, right? Is the idea of you know, you providing your services and then but the other thing that I think is also very frustrating for architects is they take up all the liability in so many ways.
They do and they don't.
Yeah.
They don't really take that much risk. That's a fiction.
Okay.
They do. I mean, you have insurance for it.
Right.
And it's expensive. It's not as bad as medical insurance.
It's not malpractice. It's not as bad as malpractice insurance.
I mean, it's a big part of the fee.
I just remember all these horror stories in architecture school that all engineers are telling us about, you know.
You got to remember that, like, when you go to your guidance counselor in high school.
Yes.
And you say, I'm a creative person. I want to change the world. But I kind of think that I'm going to fail and it's going to end tragically. Mm-hmm. They're like, architecture's for you. Like, right. You ever see The Fountainhead? Like, this is a field for you. It's tragic, creative people who are like thwarted by society. If you say I'm really creative and I've got all this vision and I want to change the world and succeed, then they send you a different place.
Right. Yeah.
So you hear a different thing from the architects because they're fundamentally tragic. They channel all the tragic creatives into architecture.
It's true. It's true. And doubt. There's so much doubt. We always have doubt. But I think is actually a good thing in architecture somehow, is having doubt in some ways. I think that overconfidence in what you're doing sometimes can not lead to iterations. I think there's something really beautiful about
– I would rephrase it as curiosity as opposed to doubt.
Well, okay. What I mean by doubt is you're going, maybe there's something better, right? That's the question I keep asking myself, right? And I think that's some of the beauty that we were originally talking about, simulation, right? It's like, maybe there's something better. Okay, change a few variables, hit simulate again, and maybe something better will come up. So I think that iteration is something that's fascinating to me. It reminds me, there's a long conversation I had with my VFX supervisor, Eric Barba, right, who went to Art Center. And so he was really into, you know,
automotive design, et cetera, and that process of craftsmanship is what he called it, right? And he said you have to keep doing something and crafted until it's beautiful. And I said, well, I went to architecture school, and I said, if it ain't working, I throw it away and I start all over again. I keep going, and nothing's precious, right? To him, it was, it's precious until it's beautiful. And then to me, it's like, it's never precious. I'm just going to keep trying something different, you know?
Yep.
And I think that's an architect's point of view, is to iterate that way in an interesting way.
Well, at least in the design process. It's precious once you start building the thing.
No, and it's a great field. The legacy you have to draw from and the continuity. We look at things that are thousands of years old and get inspired by them, like within our field. Yeah. So that's what's great about it.
Right.
The biggest mistake I've ever made was when I started using a lot of software and, started going to conferences, and like rooms full of architects would say, nobody's ever going to use that stuff. We're always going to design with a pencil. Nobody's ever going to design with a computer. Like, we may use that for drafting skyscrapers, but the creative part is never going to have anything to do with the computer. And I believed him. Wow. I was like, you know
what? When was this?
That was like the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And I thought, they're probably right. I got lots of time. Like, I've got like my whole lifetime to play around with this computer thing because nobody's interested.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you started to see even corporate firms.
Right.
Like Peter Pran and HOK. And I'm like, whoa, they're like doing blob buildings.
Right.
And I realized this is really happening fast. And then Patrick and Zaha and all kinds of people, Tom buys 3D printers, and it's like, whoa, this is really moving fast.
Yeah.
And so it is a field that's capable of like turning on a dime.
Yeah. It was fast. It was around 2001. A friend of mine who used to work at Tom Inn's office, and they says, oh, let's go visit him. I was at Gensler at the time, and we were both at Gensler, and we were the 3D guys there. He says, let's go visit Tom Inn, because, he invited us to go see stuff over at Morphosis. And this first time I saw used in architecture a 3D printer, right? And it was one of those Z-Corp printers. You remember the plaster ones, right?
Yeah, sure.
And what was fascinating about it is like, as opposed to the process that I was witnessing from Frank Gehry, where it's like, I've created this model, now let's figure out how to build this, right? But to them, it was like, I've made this on the computer now, because that's the only place I could make something like this. So I'm going to 3D print it and add it back to the physical model and now continue the process there. So it was a back and forth design process that was happening between the physical world and the computer world that was going back and forth. And the fact that it was even more interesting is that because it was printed out of plaster, you could continue to manually sculpt it after the fact as well.
Yep.
So it was that the fact that the language could happen between the physical and digital world and continuously create a loop between those two worlds.
Yep.
I think that was really, really cool. And that was, 2001. So nowadays, that's changed so much. And I think that there's so much more, which brings me to where I want to talk about virtual reality and augmented reality. I'm sure you have some really interesting thoughts on that process and how that's going to change the physical world and the design world.
Yeah, for me, augmented reality or mixed reality, it's huge.
Right.
And I would say that kind of two things happened at the same time. I'd done a bunch of stuff for Swarovski, and Nadia asked me to do jewelry.
Okay, yeah.
And it was around maybe a year before I got my hands on a HoloLens.
Okay.
And I remember, I've never really been surprised by something physical off the screen. Like, I always feel like, yeah, that's more or less what I expected.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But when we 3D printed the jewelry, I was like, oh my God, that's terrible. And it's because I was looking at it on a screen at like 10 times the size of what it really was.
Right.
And I was used to looking at a thing on a screen that was like 1/100th of what it would be.
Right.
And it was a shocker. Then when I put on HoloLens, I realized you can kind of we started using it for the robots. Like, will the robot fit under a table? Well, let's make a augmented reality robot and just look and see if it fits under the table.
Right. We'll put them anywhere. Yeah. Wherever we want them to go.
And so that, scale.
Yeah, that kind of centimeter level refinement.
Yep.
When you can put a thing from the virtual world in the real world and see how it relates to all the stuff.
Right.
It was game changing. I mean, for me anyway.
Yes.
So it wasn't so much walking around in a one-to-one thing. It was getting to see like a factory that would fit in like the office. So 30 foot long, getting to walk a kilometer right. and see that and see it physically and that like in the room with you. And then getting to see like, you know, what something would look like at table size and then go out in the parking lot and look at a big size. It's having it in the world and off the screen. It's amazing. It's not so much getting to walk around it. It's actually getting to scale it in reference to things that are familiar and physical.
Yeah.
So I think that part, it really changes the way you design.
Right.
I think it'll very much change the way people interact with content. Although that, I'm not so sure where it goes. I mean, I know for construction in Vienna, a couple of my students, well, we've been playing with it now since Microsoft kind of, you know, had me do demos. So 3-4 years, The students at the Angewandte have had HoloLenses and Tango tablets and things.
Right.
And they'll take a 1/10 model of Ronchamp and cut all the parts and put them in a bin and go out on the Ringstrasse with strangers and have them put HoloLenses on and build models based on instructions that are in AR. And
wow.
They're building like 10-meter long mock-ups in like 20 hours with untrained strangers.
That's amazing.
So it's totally going to change the way you build.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's how the pyramids were built.
I mean, it takes an unskilled person and suddenly makes you incredibly skilled.
Yes.
And kind of almost like a manual or something. Yeah, I think it's like a really powerful tool.
That's awesome.
They should use that at IKEA, how to assemble this.
Oh, that's, you know,
they're on it. No, they're on.
Yeah, they're definitely on it.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? Is an assembly process and understanding that augmented reality can be really a game changer for the construction process because I've worked construction when I was, in undergrad. It was my summers. I was framing houses and stuff. It's like going through those plans. I was like, oh, wait, where does this go? How does this work? And it took someone with a lot of skill to show me how to do that or how to read that information. And I would just do the cutting, right? So I was the dumb guy doing the cutting. But the ability to like, nope, this goes here, you know? I remember even Lars Lerup, you know, we were joking around at Rice University and he was saying, what if the brick told you where it wanted to go and it's supposed to you putting it there? And that seems so silly at the time, but nowadays, like, yeah, that's probably going to happen.
That's
right?
How it'll go. No, I think there was a lot there for me. There was a lot made about VR, like for client convincing.
Yes.
And I've tried that a few times also with AR. It always is a disaster. Because people are walking around, they're looking at the wrong thing, misunderstanding.
The right.
It's like, no, you know, you're doing it wrong. So that's almost the last thing I would ever do is put a VR presentation on somebody's head and have them go off into a VR world.
Right.
But to do that for somebody that has to build something or repair something or assemble something,
yeah,
it's an incredibly powerful tool.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is, you're right, because what's interesting about the VR world specifically is the field that embraced it more than anything, it's actually the architecture world.
Yeah.
Because it's so logical that like the whole point of VR is to take you to a place that doesn't exist and that's what architects are doing, right?
Yep.
So I'm just sort of wondering if you still, I mean, obviously, you mentioned, you know, some of the challenges of giving a VR presentation and obviously trying to dictate what people are looking at. So how do you get around that, or do you just try something different?
Well, no, I think it's really great to be able to have even a physical model and then digitally augment it and say, like, here's a circulation path, here's the sequence of construction, here's, you know, in different colors, the different functions. We use it all the time for that.
Right.
But it's almost always a phone or a tablet, because it's more collective, because two or three people can look at it. Mm-hmm. And it's always locked to a physical thing. And it's just adding information to that, which is either explanatory or analytic. It's not immersive.
Okay.
And I got to say, like, you know, Piaggio Fast Forward's best acquaintances, we're not really friends yet, but the people we feel the most kinship with is Niantic.
Okay. Yeah.
And Pokemon Go. Yep.
Right.
Because their whole mission was, like, let's get people having adventures, going to new places, you know, being social, and out in the world off the screen. And so how, like, counterintuitive, like, we're a game company, but we're going to get people out off the screen and into the world.
Oh, yeah.
But with AR. And Pokemon Go is still, like, the greatest thing ever. Because you see, like, every age group, you know, grandparents to their grandkids, all like going around to Pokestops and just like even traveling together for it.
I didn't do it as much, but I do remember when I, you know, when my son Brady was really into it, one day I came home with him and he was just like crawling on the floor exhausted because we walked 5 miles, you know, and it was just like, it was a long adventure. And like, we got to go here, we got to go there. And that was kind of an amazing thing, right?
Yep.
And I remember the thing that was interesting is like people were criticizing it, but not really realizing, do you realize everyone's out of their house?
Right. How good it was.
Yeah. Out of their like, you know, gaming chair with speakers and vibration and off their like 30-inch diagonal monitor.
Yeah.
That would be brilliant marketing for the robot is like you, just anybody can have their own AR robot. And so every time you look, you're like, oh, he could be back there carrying my groceries or, you know, all the stuff that he could be doing for you is always there.
Well, where do you think, you know, obviously AR has a very practical use, as you mentioned, in construction. But do you feel that AR will become completely pervasive where it's actually part of you every day? And then in that world, will there be a new role of architecture that exists solely in the augmentation part of the reality?
Definitely could be. I mean, Trimble's got a whole bunch of really smart architects that are trying to think about how to make that experience useful and meaningful between the augmented stuff and the physical stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, what architects are have always been responsible. Like, we make drawings. Like, we don't build stuff. We do the virtual thing that helps you physicalize it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think there's probably a lot to be done there. But I do think it's probably more it's not going to be a medium, I don't think. I think it's going to be applications.
Okay.
So I don't really think a lot of people are going to go through augmented buildings or have augmented building experiences.
Okay.
I think a lot of people are going to have little bits of augmented information all over the real world.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, headsets are going to have to get lighter and people are going to have to be comfortable with glasses. There's a lot of things to solve, it seems to be getting solved pretty quickly.
But do you think, like, for example, you know, one of the conversations we had is like, if you basically have a really good, you know, let's say we take augmentation to where it needs to be in terms of resolution and everything else, right? Then suddenly there's no need for this TV anymore.
Yep.
Right? The TV is gone. The screens are gone. All screens are gone. Phones are gone. Everything is all through augmentation. And so the world around you without the glasses will look very different, possibly very plain.
Could be.
Yeah.
No, definitely could be. I mean, it's there's still a lot of time people spend on screens for entertainment and gaming.
Yes.
And I think they'll have definitely a role in that. And that's what I associate those screens with.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening on, I forget what film it was, where they said, why is everybody carrying little televisions, but like on smartphones?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening on a phone now that probably could be augmented. Right. I think that stuff will probably get augmented faster.
Okay.
And like the number of times you go to your phone for information or to tell you how to cook something or tell you how to do something.
Yep.
Like that's where augmentation for me is really effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like if that can get off my phone and get localized to a physical thing in the world, like, you know, lay itself down flat on the table and have the instructions sitting on the table while I'm trying to cook.
Yeah.
Or have it stick to the wall because that happens to be where I'm working.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff I think is very powerful. For me, much more, I think, hard to compete with like a 4K monitor for entertainment.
Yeah, but what it, I mean, do you think that it'll be a while, I guess, before you can get AR to beat a resolution of a 4K monitor, right?
Yeah. And there's just something about, like, for me, like that, I also like that entertainment to be in a place where I know I can shut it off or turn it on. Right. Yeah. I don't know if I want it, like, all the time.
Yeah, I know. I'd agree with you, too. Do you think, but, you know, what I really like about some of the things that you've discussed, you mentioned Niantic and your robots, you seem to be pushing people to appreciate nature more, right? And that is something that I think is fascinating. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, I wouldn't try to be predicting too much. The amount of time people spend on screens and also the demographics of it is really disturbing. You know, that say, you know, people in their 40s and 50s are spending more time on screens than teenagers and people in their 20s. Like, that's kind of a surprise. But it's true. When I think about how much screen time we consume, it, for me, just made me think, like, how do we have a high-tech world, like higher tech than what's on the screen, but like in the world rather than just on devices?
Right.
And that's probably just because that's more of an architectural perspective of thinking spatially rather than device-wise.
Right.
But that's, you know, definitely the world I would want my kids to live in and I would want to live in more than, like, you know, a self-driving car with a 60-inch flat screen as a windshield.
Right.
Like that, right. That world does not sound like a world I want to live in.
Yeah, the thing that's becoming really troubling when you sort of think about all the companies that are investing the most into self-driving cars or things like that are technology companies, because that frees you up from driving and into looking at a screen, right? So that's the...
Well, it's just a new screen.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a new way to gather information on you at all times.
Right. So that's the...
it's pretty transparent.
It is pretty transparent. But I think that there's so many different ways of... I don't know. I still like driving, personally. But or being in a car, that's an experience that's nice to drive, right? But I think that's because I am still... My equivalent of screen time when I drive is listening to podcasts or things of that nature, right? So it's an audio experience as opposed to a screen experience, but it's not dissimilar from just watching a YouTube video.
Yep.
Sense, right? So there's different ways that you can experience space besides the visual space as well. There's also a lot of sound and other things that you can experience. So I think that the digital world has, you know, let's just take, you know, assistants for the house that are having now. So your Google Home, your Alexas, et cetera. Those are all voice and audio. That's a very, who would have thought that your smart home was just going to be these little boxes that you talk to all day long.
Right.
It's a very strange thing. I've recently started to smart up my house a little bit and it's like, it's kind of weird. You know, I can turn this off. I can schedule this. But it's all done through a voice, right?
Yep.
What are your thoughts on smart homes and where they're going to go?
Well, I mean, so the robotics company started, frankly, because we did this funny, it wouldn't actually doesn't translate in a verbal description, but we did this a model of a very compact house where volumes could roll around and reconfigure. So you could fit more house in a smaller thing.
Uh-huh.
But we built the robotics for it and then used Touch OSC.
Okay.
So you could control it with your phone. So we put it on exhibition and people could download Touch OSC and download our screen and control this model and drive it around.
Right.
And I said, you know, why don't we put some stepper motors on the conference room table and some chairs and we can all have Touch OSC devices and drive the furniture around.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to couple of the biggest furniture manufacturers and said, look, we've done like chairs before, but why don't we do furniture that you can drive with your phone? And why don't you fund me to do a back end that would let the furniture know where it was in space. And we put Bluetooth antennas and transponders in the office and we're measuring where furniture was. And I had this idea that, you know, your workplace or your house or, you know, whatever market, the furniture would all be able to move. It would know where it was at certain times of the day and it would predict where to go. And you would have this whole relationship with your environment that was much more like a farm of things that were semi-intelligent and just knew where to go. Yeah. And, you know, it would make you more aware of your environment, more fun, you know, maybe more efficient.
Yeah.
You know, but the furniture manufacturers are like, we know we're going to have to do this, but we don't want to do it.
Why don't they want to do it?
Because it's expensive.
Well, it's expensive. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
So... but anyway, so that's where the work with Piaggio came from.
Interesting.
But for me, that's what a smartphone would be. It would be having a relationship with your home.
Right.
Which was not like the home was telling you what to do, but also not like a command center where you're just like barking orders at your table. You know, I think it's more interesting if your table is in a different place because it knows that this time of day you like to have it over there.
Right.
So... But that's a lot of the stuff we're doing, honestly, with the teaching I do. It's all about thinking about how to mobilize the environment with intelligence.
Right.
You know, rather than to, like, let's say, empower the user with all this authority, which I find a little bit less interesting.
Yeah. And I also think people barking orders at stuff is kind of weird. I do it all the time and I feel weird, still feel strange about it. It'd be nice if things knew what I needed. Yeah. You know?
Well, we're very specific to be polite to... Alexa.
Right. To teach it manners?
Well, to make sure that our daughter doesn't learn to bark orders at people or things, you know, like yelling, set a timer.
Yeah.
Google Assistant actually will reward you for doing things like that now.
But I didn't know that.
But, yeah. It'll say, when you say thank you, it'll actually respond and you'll get some points or whatever for doing that.
So one of the things that's fascinating me, and when you're talking about the house design, I still find for this. So currently at the moment, we had a little bit of a catastrophe with a water leakage and a dishwasher, and my kitchen has been, you know, down to the studs for since November. And you know, we're finally getting cabinets and blah blah blah. But thinking about it, right, you can't help but think. You know, you go through the sketch of the layout of how the cabinets are going to work, and I know exactly what stuff I have and all of this. And I'm thinking, like, shouldn't I just be able to take a picture of the stuff that I have? Like, here's all the things that I have and the appliances that I have and so on. And, like, shouldn't AI just go, here's a cabinet, the cabinet layout that's totally conformed to how it should be for the optimized movement of your space and what you have, or here's another alternative and blah, blah, blah. And the answer obviously is yes. Like, yes, that should be able to happen. And we had a guest on the podcast recently who had started a company called Promethean AI. Mm-hmm. And he you know, this connects to the being able to talk to your interface as well. He basically said, you know, as artists are creating models, and specifically this was more for game content, but it could be used in lots of different ways. They spend a lot of time trying to find the right couch and the assets and set dress and put it all together. And he's like, if I just load up a database of all these things and I have the AI learn it so that it knows what it's got and what a couch is and what a blah, 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 what a room is, he just hits the button. He goes, Promethean AI, build me a bedroom. And even more specifically, he's like, build me a bedroom for like a 1980s movies fan. And it populates the room and it does an amazing job. And then it's like, oh, well, I don't quite like where the dresser is, or I don't quite like where this is. And you're like, move the dresser into the corner or find me a new dresser. And that whole concept, I feel, is going to me, that'll change everything, including like I'm looking at AR in my kitchen. That's, you know, that I need new cabinets in it. And I'm like, you know, show me the optimized layout for the kitchen. Okay, show it to me in blah, 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 blah. All right, like, let's go build that.
But what are your thoughts on deep learning and AI and how that's going to change the design process?
Well, so, I mean, we train the robots. So
of course that's, yeah,
we don't program them. We train them.
Right.
And it's very clear. I mean, I've seen examples of training a machine to look at bathrooms, like, you know, code compliant bathrooms. And you just make a shape and plan, and it'll just, you can just keep hitting the button. It'll give you new layouts that are all code compliant, and you can pick one.
Wow.
So tools like that, they're, I think AI is very powerful for that.
Right.
If you want to retrain a robot, you have to start from almost zero. Mm-hmm. Same thing, you want to train a car, you got to start from zero. No, there's no logic there.
Right.
And there's no code there. It's a massive database.
Yeah, right.
And it's very hard to change a thing by just pouring more data into it.
Right.
So it's got limitations.
Because in some ways it has to unlearn what it's learned to learn the new thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's, you know, well, like, I, you know, I have dogs. I grew up on a farm. I mean, you just give them a treat and eventually they're trained.
Yeah.
But it's, they don't understand always the logic of why they're doing what they're doing.
Right. You know?
So it, that's a very different proposition. So I think AI today is very useful for training things to do either rote tasks or training things with enormous databases. But it's different than designing a building, let's say.
Yeah, sure.
So I do, but by the way, AI is very young. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the next 10 years. But right now, it's a little bit frustrating to spend too much time training a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Knowing that you're going to have to, you know, it'll be obsolete very soon.
Yeah.
But back to, you know, how you were talking about crowd simulations and things like that. I mean, one of the things that I think is fascinating is, you know, yes, you can build something and then run a simulations and then adjust it. On the other hand, you should be able to take lots and lots of simulations of things. Like, I'm going to run, you know, millions of crowd simulations of things. Here's the crowd that we are going to have. Design me the optimum space for that layout. Like, the ability to have AI learn from those simulations is, I think, going to be a huge next step.
Yep. You have to know what you're optimizing towards.
Yep.
If you know that, like a bathroom.
Right. Right. Yeah. If it can be defined.
Then it's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's right. Because, the thing about AI, by its very nature, it is only giving you things based on things it already knows. Right. So it's always going to be based on something that already exists. So it's, you know, it's going to be evolutionary in design at best. Yep. So you're never going to have something, you know, I don't want to say innovative, but you're not going to have something that's completely revolutionary, because it's hard to do that out of thin air.
Yep.
Because that's the whole point of deep learning, is that it's learned from a database of existing things. Right. So it's fascinating. Well, we are actually over an hour, but I want to make sure that we have a chance to for you to share any new information that people may be able to look up about you, or new things that's coming up that our listeners would be interested in finding out about the cool things you're doing.
Well, if you see little round adorable robots following people around in one of 20 cities this summer, they're called Jeetahs.
That's awesome.
But that's, you know, that's the big thing that's going on for me in the next couple months.
That's so great. Cool. When is there going to be an LA sort of event or launch?
Yeah. So it's one thing to explain this on a radio show.
Yeah.
It's another thing to have somebody just touch a robot and have them follow them around.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
You don't get it unless you experience it.
Right.
So, yeah. So
I want to go. I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, no. We'll be around. We'll be around in.
And are they going to be available for sale?
Yep.
And so, what, there's sales happening sometime this summer?
Yep. And so we're going to have.
Price has been announced on these things?
No, we won't say until we're ready to go to market. But
much
less than you'd think for a thing capable of doing all this. But
wow.
But yeah, we'll have kind of two teams going up and down the East Coast and the West Coast starting this summer, and spending, you know, a week in a city and town. And honestly, it's much more for, like, where people live, like in their neighborhoods.
Okay.
So you're more likely to see one at the farmer's market,
mm-hmm,
than you are on, like, the Third Street Promenade or something.
Right.
It's really about helping people just walk around their neighborhood. So that's where we'll be.
Interesting. And where can they find information? Is there a website they're going to be able to find all this information?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. if anybody Googles myjita.com,
okay,
you can see some of the prototypes.
Okay.
And in another couple months, people will be able to see what's for sale.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, that's very exciting. I'm excited we were able to talk about that because it's going to change everything, right?
I think we need one for the office.
We do need one for the office.
For reasons.
Exactly. I was talking, Lon and I was, everyone's like, we need one of these new things for reasons. Yeah. It's perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping by and hanging out in the garage.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation.
All right. Thanks, Greg. All right.